hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Lawmakers in Springfield have just a few days left to hammer out a balanced state budget amid funding challenges. 6 months after being sworn in, we talk with Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke about how she's reshaping the office.
When it comes to Chicago food, there's a holy trinity.
And a local entrepreneur is taking a bite out of Chicago's food scene, one chip at a time. And now to some of today's top stories. Mayor Brandon Johnson responded today to questions about the ongoing Department of Justice investigation into the hiring of city employees.
Administration, again, is more interested in the country club than the country. You know, my administration speaks to the values of the people of this city and around the country. And as we continue to drive violence down in the city of Chicago, and as our investments continue to go up, it is proof positive that my administration not only reflects the values and the diversity and the competency of our city, but there are actual positive results that we can speak to.
Analysis from WTTW News shows the mayor has tapped more black Chicagoans to serve in positions of authority than Chicagoans of other races in the over 100 appointments he's made in his first 2 years. Overall, the city's workforce is 38% white, 29% black, 26% Latino, and 3% Asian American, according to city data. For more on that analysis, please visit our website. Homeowners who experienced damage during recent severe weather should stay alert for another kind of storm coming through their neighborhood. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is warning residents to be on alert for scammers looking to exploit those in need of repairs, adding, they often move quickly to put pressure on people with damaged homes and businesses. Instead, Raoul suggests consumers ask friends for worker recommendations or visit the Better Business Bureau website. He also says you should obtain a copy of a signed contract before work starts and ask for required state and local permits or licenses. A full list of tips is on our website. Three people were killed in shootings across Chicago over Memorial Day weekend. Chicago police say 24 people were also shot. That's down from 9 killed and 41 shot in 2024, and 11 killed and 50 people shot in 2023, making this year one of the least deadly holiday weekends in the city in recent years. So far in 2025, city data shows homicides are down 23% and shootings down 35%. Deputy Mayor of Community Safety Garion Gatewood praised police, city departments, and community leaders for their work towards the declining rates.
I can't thank our agencies enough. You know, every commander in the city was out this weekend, and the mayor will talk about that. The Chicago Police Department was out in full force, along with our street outreach partners, our city agencies, to continue to drive violence down.
National Public Radio and three of its local stations have filed a lawsuit against President Donald Trump's executive order aimed at cutting its federal funding. The suit argues that Trump's order violates the First Amendment and aims to, quote, punish NPR for the content of news and other programming the president dislikes. The order, which was signed earlier this month, directs the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to, quote, cease federal funding for NPR and PBS, after the administration alleged bias in their content. PBS is likely to file a separate challenge soon. Up next, lawmakers have just a few more days to pass a balanced state budget. Our Nick Blumberg is live in Springfield with a preview.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
It's crunch time for state lawmakers. The Illinois General Assembly returned from the long weekend break for its final week of the spring session. In addition to tackling the state budget, some big issues are still unresolved, including possible reforms to the state pension system and Chicagoland public transit. Our Nick Blumberg joins us now live from Springfield. Nick, we know you've been covering that $770 million cliff that is facing transit. Does it look like there is a fix in sight?
That's right, Brandis. Lawmakers and other stakeholders have been hard at work negotiating legislation that would make some changes to the way transit is run. Lawmakers have been pretty consistent that they're not going to come up with that needed money to tackle the fiscal cliff without reform. Now, a person who's close to the negotiations told me they have been hurrying to finalize the language so that members can actually, you know, read it. The idea would be better coordination of things like fare policy or capital projects at a regional level, and that the existing transit systems would be left to do operations, running buses and trains. There also have been conversations about coming up with money to, you know, fill in that massive budget gap. Those talks are still underway. They've been getting some more attention in recent days. You know, folks have floated lots of ideas over the last year and a half, things like using some of the state's money for roads, things like, you know, expanding the sales tax base to cover services. But this is a big budget gap to tackle with not a lot of time left, which is making some transit advocates worried that we might just see reform in this session and no money stuff until veto session, but people are still hopeful there can be a deal getting done.
And Nick, we know Governor Pritzker has proposed extra funding for the state's pension system. What do we know about that?
That's right. The governor says he would like to see an extra $78 million go toward tier two pensions. Now, those are for state employees who started after 2011. They have a later retirement date and more modest payouts. Now, the concern is that the benefits have to meet the standards of the federal safe harbor law, which says that those pensions have to be equal to Social Security benefits. Now, this is not a new issue for lawmakers. It's something unions have been raising the alarm about, in particular, in a letter to the governor just today. It is still to be determined what the final number looks like there and where that money comes from, as well as if there are any other reforms in addition to some more funding, perhaps.
And we heard late last week that the Bears are once again focusing on a move to Arlington Heights. Could lawmakers be interested in helping them out?
Well, lawmakers, legislative leaders, they've been pretty clear the Bears should not expect a big tranche of public funding. But there could be some action on an idea to let a so-called mega project like that potential Arlington Heights Stadium and Entertainment District negotiate with local governments over the property tax they pay. There have been multiple proposals on that subject, so lawmakers will need to reach a compromise deal by the end of an already very busy week.
And Nick, lastly, what else can we expect to see in the final days of session?
Well, as you said right at the top, it's budget crunch time. Lawmakers have until Saturday to pass a budget with a simple majority. If they blow the deadline, they can do it with a three-fifths vote, a supermajority, but they really don't want to do that. There are some other proposals as well that we've been telling folks about, things like banning cell phones in classrooms. That passed the Senate last month, and it's currently in the House where it's gotten some amendments to make sure there are exceptions where appropriate. We've also been following that pitch to allow community colleges to offer certain four-year degrees. That made it out of a House committee last week, but the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus has reportedly voiced its opposition to the bill, so it's unclear where that plan is headed. But yes, there is going to be plenty to keep us busy down here this week.
I'm sure you'll stay there for us and keep us posted. Nick Blumberg there in Springfield. Up next, we're one-on-one with Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke. Stay with us. At her swearing-in 6 months ago, Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke promised a new approach to tackling violent crime. Key to that approach has been asking her prosecutors to seek pretrial detention for more suspects, especially those charged with felony firearm cases. Since Burke took office, Cook County Jail's population has grown from around 5,200 at the end of her predecessor Kim Fox's term to just under 5,800 now. But critics say violent crime was already trending down in the city and the country and question the need for Burke's tougher approach to crime. Joining us now to give us her take, the job so far, and her efforts to reshape the office is Judge Eileen O'Neill Burke, Cook County State's Attorney, and of course, so our viewers are aware, you're of course a former Circuit County clerk.
Hence, I was on the appellate court.
Oh, the appellate court.
Excuse me. You demoted me, but I put myself back up.
Hence the judge. So as discussed, you recently announced the creation of a choice protection unit in your office, focusing on ensuring women access to reproductive services. Tell us more about that unit and why you wanted to create that, why it was necessary.
So I'm a law nerd. So when Dobbs came down, I was starting to think about, well, Illinois is going to be one of the few places in the Midwest that you're going to be able to have abortion services. So I started looking at what would the potential charges be for someone who was coming here to interfere with that right. And it could be anything from ordinance violations, noise violations, blocking a roadway, all the way up to assaults, batteries, and we tried to get a terrorism legislation passed in the legislature within the last few months in order to have another tool in our toolbox to deter people from coming to Illinois. We've had an 80% increase of women coming to Illinois from other states in order to get reproductive health services. With that is going to be women who, or people who want to interfere with women exercising their right to reproductive health. So we need to be ready for it. So as I was looking at the multitude of statutes that could come into play, it became very apparent to me that these are not the type of cases that can just land on your desk and you would know what to do. So we've formed a choice protection unit, which is a voluntary unit, which ASAs have volunteered to come in and, in addition to their regular court call, be trained on what are the statutes that are available to us, what trends are we seeing in other legislators and other states all across the country, and let's have training on it so that we're not caught on our back foot. We're ready to go. And having this unit is also a deterrent. It sends a very strong message that we take this very seriously in Cook County, and we will prosecute anyone who is interfering with a woman by engaging in criminal conduct.
And of course, that training is so that your ASAs can recognize a case where someone is intentionally attempting to thwart someone's effort to receive that care.
And doing so in a criminal manner.
Of course.
Once they commit that crime, we will prosecute, and we want to be ready for that.
What about the actions of other states who might legally target reproductive health care providers in this state? Will that unit be able to look at those as well? Is that the kind of thing that...
That would normally be within the province of the Attorney General's office. But we will be addressing any time a crime is committed in Cook County. What we wanted to get through the legislature in this session was a terrorism bill. Terrorism is currently a state statute that we can utilize when a terrorist act occurs in a hospital. Well, that it's a very real threat. Peoria and Danville both have had clinics bombed, and it is a very real threat that we need to have terrorism in our state statute. We cannot guarantee that the federal government will pursue terrorism charges when someone commits a terrorist act on an abortion clinic. So we wanted to amend the statute to include abortion and reproductive health services clinics as well as hospitals.
Your views on pretrial detention and electronic monitoring. So you've directed, as we mentioned, your prosecutors to object on the record whenever they have sought detention and a judge instead opts for electronic monitoring or home confinement. Why was that important to you? Why did you want to do that?
There is a significant problem right now with electronic monitoring. It is being transferred from Sheriff Dart's office to the chief judge's umbrella. The problem is pretrial officers within the chief judge's office do not have arrest authority. So if someone cuts off their band or goes AWOL on electronic monitoring, those pretrial officers do not have the authority to go and arrest someone. They don't have the authority to come and ask for an arrest warrant. You need a law enforcement personnel to do that. Those are significant problems with the electronic monitoring system. In addition, we have 40 to 50 people that are charged with murder or attempt murder on electronic monitoring. Those are not appropriate charges for electronic monitoring. My job is to make sure that people who are a danger to the public, that we do everything we can to detain them. If someone is not a danger to the public, we are not asking for detention. So there's many low-level felony cases that somebody doesn't present a danger. If someone is carrying a machine gun or a gun with a switch, converting it into an automatic weapon, they present a danger to the public. Those cases we seek detention on. If someone commits a violent crime, a aggravated battery where someone goes to the hospital, a violent assault on someone where they're going to the hospital, we ask for detention. We're also asking for detention anytime someone commits a violent crime on the CTA. In order to have a safe, thriving community, we need to have a safe public transportation system, and we do not have that. We can send a very strong deterrent message by asking for detention and jail time when someone presents a danger to the public.
As a former judge yourself, some critics say that this sort of undermines the discretionary authority of judges to make that decision. Well, yes, it is a violent crime, but looking at the facts of this case, I'm still going to order electronic monitoring. What do you say to that argument?
Well, when we first came in, we knew that there was a significant problem. There was a significant problem in our assistants getting the access to all of the databases. So we have a feed from CPD, but we didn't have access to the chief judge's information. We didn't have access to the sheriff's information. We didn't have access to a lot of court files. So I'll give you an example of why this was significant for us going into first appearance court. A man came out from detention. The state was asking for detention on someone. It's a brand new assistant state's attorney in the courtroom. Judge says, why are you asking for detention on this? The allegation in the petition was he left a basket of gifts for his children on his ex-wife's porch. And why would you ask for detention on that? And the state's attorney couldn't answer the question sufficiently. The judge luckily had come from civil court and knew how to get into the civil court system. She took a look at the divorce files, pulled out the order of protection. It turned out that this person had taken the children, absconded to Indiana, barricaded himself in a hotel room. They had to surround the hotel with a SWAT team while he threatened to kill himself and the children. Well, that's significantly different than I left a basket of gifts on my ex-wife's porch. That was why the state was asking for detention, and yet we did not have access to that information. So we immediately embedded two investigators over in first appearance court so that they could start plumbing all of the information that we need to have to give the most full picture to courts when we are seeking detention on why and why do they present a danger.
You've also you've expanded a pilot of the felony bypass review program. Now that is in two districts, Inglewood and Calumet. This one allows police officers to skip getting approval from your office if they need a felony weapons charge once they've had a lieutenant sign off on it. Why did you want to expand this? What are your measures of success?
Let me break that down a little bit. They're just for class 4 gun cases, which means it's a handgun. It's not an automatic weapon, and it's a handgun, and somebody doesn't have the appropriate licensing, a FOID card, a fire owner's identification card. So it's really just a registration issue. It is not a issue of somebody is presenting a danger to the public, and we're saying that you can bypass felony review. We're one of the few jurisdictions in the entire country that does a felony review. So what it is when a police officer has made an arrest on a felony, they call felony review to review the case and determine if there's a sufficient basis to hold that case into first appearance court or a preliminary hearing. There are certain types of cases that assistant state's attorneys go out on. If it's a victim case, if it's, a violent crime, assistant state's attorneys go out to the police station and they interview those witnesses. If it's a gun case, there's no interview of anyone. It's the police officer is giving you that information over the phone. There was a 90% approval rate on those types of cases that were brought to us. So
sounds like this just, and I just want to get to one more thing before we run out of time, because it sounds like this accelerates the process for something.
Officers were off the street for 6 hours waiting to get felony review approval. That was a logjam. That's people not getting their 911 calls responded to in a timely manner. So we took at who's waiting the longest on 911 calls and who has sufficient gun cases to have us do this training. So we went out and we trained every single officer in both of those districts on exactly what we need.
No.
And every single one of those cases has made it through preliminary hearing. So
that said, Cook County Public Defender and some aldermen are concerned about a couple of things, that sort of critical layer of oversight that they believe is missing. But also, these we're talking about two predominantly black communities that are receiving this pilot of a program so far. And they feel like those two communities are being treated differently. In 30 seconds, what do you say to that?
Illinois State Police is doing training now, and they cover all the roadways in Cook County. So that will cover everyone from Winnetka down to Sauk Village. It will cover everyone. So the other thing was, those were the communities that were waiting the longest on 911 calls. Had nothing to do with race. It had to do with the efficiencies that we needed to implement.
Okay. We've got 15 seconds left, Justice Eileen O'Neill Burke. Thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck. We look forward to having you join us again.
Thank you.
Of course. And we're back with more right after this. Elements of Chicago culture are built on some of the city's most famous foods: deep dish pizza, Italian beef, and of course, the classic Chicago-style hot dog. Now, a local entrepreneur is putting all of those flavors in the bag and adding a little crunch to the city's food scene.
I love potato chips, and I love Chicago food, and I thought it would be a really fun way to celebrate Chicago if we smashed the two things together.
That mashup led Laura Gardner and her husband David to create Local Style Potato Chip.
We wanted the best chip base for this product. We didn't just want to make these taste like Chicago's famous foods. We wanted to put them on a kettle-cooked potato chip that would be downright delicious.
Cooking up the flavors was no challenge.
The flavors were almost the easy part to select, because when it comes to Chicago food, there's a holy trinity, and you've got Italian beef, and you've got Chicago hot dog, and you've got deep dish pizza.
And locals are already finding some fan favorites.
Like, I was stunned by the hot dog flavor. I was like, this is like when they talk about like a Chicago style hot dog being like dragged through a garden. I was like, this is what it's like. Like, it's like a party in your mouth. It's so good.
But Gardner didn't stop there.
The hot jardinera I knew needed to be the next flavor after that. It's Chicago's best kept secret.
Those best kept secrets are just some of what makes Local Style so flavorful.
I love the logo. I love the illustrations, which are so fun.
Chicago food is so much more than just the food. We wanted to give it a personality, like walking on a happy, bright Chicago summer day. Like, that was sort of the feeling we were going for.
The cartoon designs and creative flavors are popping up across Chicago's neighborhoods.
We started in 7, and we've already grown to 17, which has been a whirlwind 3.5 weeks. That just goes to show that when, like, Chicago gets behind something, like, we can grow.
Gardner chose the first few locations to carry her product based on her history with the city.
I've lived in the West Loop. I've lived in up in Old Town. I've lived in a handful of places. And I really chose my favorite spots. Like, there wasn't much strategy to it.
But her first stop was inspired by her love of a popular Chicago show that also pays homage to the city's vibrant food scene.
I walked into Mr. Beef very nervous and was holding my chips in my arms, and I asked if the owner was here. Chris looked at the chips and he tasted the chips and fell in love with them. And the best case scenario in my head that day was that Mr. Beef would carry the chips. That was all that was on my mind. And it actually went further than that. And Chris shared the chips with his buddies and his friends at the Bear. So my very first paying customer was the Bear craft services team, which is just incredible and something I'm so, so grateful for.
And Gardner has plans to take her Chicago-style chips even further.
I think we definitely want to expand the line, asking on social media, what flavors do you guys want? We're already getting some really great social comments and ideas thrown our way, and we're like, gosh, do people really want a Malort flavor? Like, don't dare us. Like, we'll do it.
And she's taking pride in representing her adopted hometown.
I feel really proud to be bringing this to the city. I think taking our famous foods and putting them on such a fun snack like a potato chip is something that the city feels excited about, and I feel really proud to be bringing it to the city. And yeah, just very excited to see how far Chicago can take local style chips.
Malort flavored chips. In addition to Mr. Beef, you can find local style potato chips at the Goddess and Grocer locations, D'Amato's in Westtown and J.P. Graziano in Fulton Market. For more locations and details, you can visit our website. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Be sure to stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. You can also stay connected by following us on Blue Sky at WTTW. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. We speak with the creators of the new opera, She Who Dared, about exposing audiences to lesser-known Black female heroes. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.